Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
You know, the future's hard to predict. It's a complex system. And especially with what Iran seems to be doing, if their capabilities to keep the Straits of Hormuz shut down, if they actually can or deliver some major strikes in that area, we can insure all the boats in the world, but those boats aren't easy to build.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to This Finance You, this episode with Chris Martinson, of course, and with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Chris. Good to see you today.
So we're recording this here on Wednesday, March 4th, and of course, we're in the midst of this Iranian war, and it's a fog of war. Very difficult to figure out what's going on, and maybe we could talk around that a little bit. You know, my particular focus would be that I would care most about is energy. Paul, I've never seen an energy shock like this. I had to put out a special scouting report for people back at Peak Prosperity because this is literally one of the most outrageous things I could possibly imagine. We have a complete shutdown of LNG exports from the Gulf, Persian Gulf. That's 20% of world LNG. We're coming just off of our winter LNG burns, you know, our natural gas burns that is usually restocked with LNG, I should say. Europe is at really low levels. Germany is at perilously low levels. Everybody's got a restock, and 20% just came offline. And you know who's very dependent on that is South Korea. And we saw an immediate, what I would call an honest reaction by a market. And this is the KOSPI, the KOSPI, the South Korean composite stock chain. Dude, Paul, it went from 6,300-ish to 5,300-ish. Right, it lost 1,000 points. It's almost comparable. If you could imagine peeling 1,000 points off of the S&P, would be very comparable to what we're seeing here. It did this because people all of a sudden in South Korea said, they're scrambling. They have no idea where they're going to get their natural gas from. Nobody does at this point. It's a big hot mess out there in energy space. And you can see here even, Paul, they actually had to use what's called a circuit breaker. This thing's falling. It triggered the circuit breaker. It operated like it should. Of course, they don't operate this way in the United States for silver. And then when it reopened again, it just, boom. I mean, it came down, popped up, but then carried on. So the circuit breaker didn't break much of the trajectory here. Just gave them maybe time to sort of settle out orders and make sure they had a bit more of an orderly market. But that's what I think actually ought to be happening in markets all over the place if they were honestly discounting what it means to take basically 12% of world's oil off the market and 20% of the world's natural gas, and no clear sign of when it's going to come back. Nobody knows. What do you think?
The big question is the mindless robot that Mike Green talks about. I mean, we are at the first of the month, so you've got your passive, you know, price insensitive buyers that are flowing into the market, which could be causing the markets to hold up in the U.S. at this point. It just doesn't make sense. I mean, there, you know, is the market forward looking right now? It doesn't seem to be, because if it was forward looking, it'd be pricing in the inflationary impact. That's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is there's going to be those that are going to argue and say, hey, the U.S. is, you know, committed to winning this, and they're going to control all the outcomes, and the market's anticipating that. I think it's a lot of narrative out there right now, more so than anything. And I think the average person, you know, there's very few risk managers out there, tactical managers anymore. And as long as the headlines look good, your algorithms are going to be buying this market. It seems to be the narrative seems to be working here. I do think first of month money flows has something to do with the markets holding up at this point. I'm curious to see what happens next week, because the market tends to gravitate higher first week of the month, especially first 5 to 7 days.
Okay, so there could be money flows. I can't really account for this, Paul, which is we're looking here at the price of Brent crude. This is live at the time of this recording. And you can see it sort of was about $84 earlier this morning, and it's just been wobbling down all day. The news flow coming out of that region of the world is not constructive to complacency, like I'm seeing here.
Mm-hmm.
Another container ship was just like hit with a missile or a drone. It's on fire. It's burning in the actual Strait of Hormuz. The IRCG is claiming that they're going to do everything they can to keep that action up. We saw another attack on the Raz Taruna facility, which, by the way, processes 7% of the world's daily crude, comes out of Saudi Arabia, got hit again. Saudi Arabia said, oh, no, it wasn't that bad. But point is, that ought to be putting a little concern into the markets, you would think. Nope, this is full complacency. Everything is fine. I can't really make sense of this in a logical market-based way, so I have to search for other explanations.
No, I'm with you on that. I mean, one of the things that's, you know, it's rare that 28 years of doing this that I get nervous. But I get nervous when things don't make sense, when the market's not reacting the way it should. So, okay, so what am I missing? What is it that I'm seeing that I'm missing that the market's overlooking? I can't figure that out right now. And that makes, you know, that puts my head on a swivel, looking just at every single position, watching the tape, watching money flow, looking to see what's taking place, because, you know, the KOSPI is my concern. That the complacency that is here, if we're not getting the full truth out of what's coming out of actually taking place, and the market's just hoping that this thing's going to be over sooner rather than later, my concern is you're going to get a violent reaction to the downside if the narrative can't be controlled to the extent that it is right now.
Well, I wonder, too, you know, you talked about money flows with respect to retail, sort of 401k, it's an automatic flood of money at the beginning of the month, but you know what else just happened? So Dubai, it was really, I think, 8 out of 10 people who lived there were foreigners, you know, rich foreigners typically. And they just discovered that it wasn't as safe as they thought. I mean, that was the whole lure of Dubai. They had great tax structures, very safe place to live. You could leave a laptop on a car hood for hours and come back and it'd still be there. And so that was the whole allure of it. And then all of a sudden, they're finding that they have to pay $350,000 a person as of this morning to get out if they want to on a flight.
Oh my!
You know, with private somebody's banking bank on private private jet travel. But so maybe all of a sudden there's like a lot of money out there in the world that's suddenly saying I got to go somewhere else.
Right.
You know, maybe the United States is the recipient of that. I don't know. But it's not just the U.S. This was pretty well across the board. Let me see if I can pull that up real quick. So what do we see? We see the Dow Jones was selling off and then took one of those patented needle bottoms, goes this way. The S&P, same thing. NASDAQ, same thing. Russell 2000, same thing. Nikkei, same thing. Euro stocks, same thing. DAX, same thing. So now we're back to this idea, Paul, that it's less to do with maybe people saying, oh, things look good in the U.S., so you'll see the headlines, favorable jobs report, you know, the services index came out better than expected. But that shouldn't have any impact on Germany and Europe and Japan, right?
No.
Theoretically. So this looks like a wall of money got dumped in the markets to me and hit all the tapes at once, potentially.
It sure does. And technically, and I wanted to look just to verify this here, I'm looking real quick, we did... So NASDAQ was fine, but S&P, if I remember correctly, we technically broke a level of support intraday yesterday, and then we've reversed higher. Now, it's not a major level of support. Yeah, we did. We broke the most recent level of support on the close intraday and the close yesterday, and then we've bounced right back up on the other side of that. So it's a lot of it doesn't make sense. I mean, you know, we don't want investors to make emotional decisions. You've got to work your strategy. You don't want to sell just for the sake of selling, but at the same time, we're just, you know, a lot of this isn't making sense. You tend to have more emotional selling in this case, unless it's just the fact that investors are absolutely terrified to liquidate anything because of the fact that in the past, the government has had the ability to come in and bail the markets out. Now, my problem is, if I am in Dubai and I'm, you know, want to get money out of there, why do you want to put it in the S&P 500 when it's the most expensive market that we've seen historically, priced to perfection with all that could spin out of control in the Middle East? Now, we have started to see some demand come into treasuries, especially in the 5 to 7 and 10 years. So that's enough to make us wonder if we are heading up into a slowdown to where interest rates are going to come down. That I don't know. We're just seeing some reactions in there. So treasuries have seemed to get a bit out of what's taking place. But it doesn't make sense to pile in the S&P 500 when we've been consolidating. We haven't broken out of a range. We're pretty much the same level that we were going back to. Let me look here now. We're at the same level we were essentially at the end of October. So the market is range bound, and maybe there's some technical issues taking place in there to stay within that range. But a breakdown at this point could get violent, and the market could, whatever it is that causes the market to break down, if there is something, it could get violent and sell off pretty quickly. So this is a time to be cautious, especially when it just doesn't make sense, the reaction that's taken place, the complacency that's there. And it's the complacency that gets people in trouble.
Well said. So, Paul, we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, I want to talk about probably the most important chart you and I have talked about of late, and we'll see that right when we come back. Markets are facing heightened uncertainty, and thoughtful portfolio management has never been more important. If your current strategy relies solely on passive investing or diversification without active oversight, it may be time to consider a different approach. At Peak Financial Investing, we connect you with experienced wealth managers who actively manage portfolios using disciplined, research-driven strategies designed to adapt to evolving market conditions. Our focus is on helping clients navigate volatility with clarity and confidence. While no investment strategy can guarantee results or eliminate risk, we believe that preparation and active management can make a meaningful difference over time. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com to schedule a complimentary consultation and explore whether our approach aligns with your goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, and I am proud to support Peak Financial Investing. This is not a guarantee of future performance, but a call to take your financial planning seriously. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. Investing, of course, involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Please consult with a qualified advisor before making investment decisions. Welcome back, everybody. Paul, remember we went over this and you and I were opining. We're like, what could make that happen? And we noted that the famous double hump inflation of the 1970s back here was caused by that. This is the OPEC oil embargo right here. It causes that first hump, right? 73 in here. Boom. So are we about to really rhyme in history? Because it sure seems to me like we are, unless peace breaks out this minute, right? And all the companies that are operating and countries that are operating the Persian Gulf realize in that same instant that it's all good, right? It's still going to take months to sort of unwind what happened over there, right? So we just heard that they declared force majeure in Qatar. They shut down their LNG trains, they call them, the trains. So they're no longer compressing gas into liquids. And when they stop that, Paul, they're going, this is from, they had it as sort of a warm shutdown. This is a cold shutdown. So when they get to the cold shutdown, to restart it, 2 weeks to even begin producing, 4 weeks to get back to full production. That's even if peace and rainbows and unicorns break out this minute. So we're going to have this shock is coming. It's going to take a while to work its way through. Every day this persists, the chance of that inflationary shock just gets higher and higher and higher, because it's all fun and game. And maybe there's some, you know, Marco Rubio said, oh, we'll do whatever it takes to keep oil prices down. And maybe they made some calls to their buddies in Wall Street and they're selling paper, you know, oil. Fine. I don't think they can do that for more than a couple of weeks, right? So if this stretches on beyond a couple of weeks, then we're going to get into the next stage, which is where you have that, just like we saw in the silver market, like, well, officially the price is this, but if you want to actually buy some, it's that, right?
Right, right.
And we'll see that happen. And then it's only a hop, skip, and a jump where you get to what's called resource hoarding, where nations that formerly were pretty happy to skate on the edge and they have some extra oil and they ship it, maybe they think, you know what? We're going to keep this for now, right? Because mm-hmm. we don't know where this is all going. Mexico would be an example of that. Brazil might be an example of that, right?
Right.
So,
right.
Just, all right, well, Norway, prime example of that. So this, it's starting to feel a little eerie, like, okay, when we were talking about this chart the first time, I was not thinking second OPEC shock, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we kind of have one for other reasons now.
And severe potential. I mean, especially if this is a prolonged war And it continues from here. We can't anticipate what damage is going to be done. And that lack of supply, with all the fiscal spending that the government's putting out and just liquefaction across the world of the governments, that is inflationary. We're doing more of the things with less supply of a main indicator coming in. And another thing that I'm concerned about, Chris, now Trump comes out and announces that they're going to insure ships coming across and supposedly transport them through the Strait of Hormuz. But there was, you know, I knew Lloyd's of London was a major insurer across the world. I didn't realize how they are essentially the price setter for most insurance companies from a competitive standpoint, because apparently they have all kinds of connections to the intelligence community, so they can quickly, and from what I understand, they decided just to stop insuring, which kind of started to send a ripple effect across the insurance industry. And then Trump makes the announcement that they're going to, you know, we taxpayers are going to insure this at this point. And that's taken the pressure off a little bit. But we've already seen insurance costs skyrocket for property and casualty, for cars. You add an oil shock on top of this, that's just going to further exacerbate inflation. And the question is the new Fed chair actually going to raise rates, or are they going to let inflation run hot? My concern is they're going to let inflation run hot, and the next wave of inflation is not going to be a good thing for corporate earnings.
No. And so, you know, Trump came out and said that, I thought that was kind of bold, saying, hey, the American taxpayers are going to insure your private property belonging to other people in other countries. I'm like, that's a little bold. I don't know what the mechanism is for that, but I don't remember anybody declaring that we wanted to be in this war or who was actually going to pay for it, right? But Trump just came out and said, oh, we'll pay for it. You know, we got it. And second, he said, we're going to have naval escorts. Within hours, the Navy came out and said, no, we're not doing that, right? And so that, we'll have to see how that sort of detangles itself. But obviously, you know, the Strait of Hormuz is not a place you want to get caught in, because it's pretty tight. This just came out today. So I go to this place, UKMTO on Twitter, which every time there's an attack or a suspected incident with a ship, it goes up on their website. So they said here this morning, they received an incident 2 nautical miles north of Oman. So right in the heart. And again, this is the Strait of Hormuz. And it's not just that it's tight, Paul, it's that these are giant ships. And this is a very sharp corner. So they basically have to slow down and turn broadside, you know, as they're executing that turn, which just is a very vulnerable sort of a position to be in. And in this case, they said here, quote, a container ship has reported being hit by an unknown projectile just above the waterline, causing a fire in the engine room. So don't know, but that projectile sounds a bit like a missile to me, because it was just above the waterline like that. So it wasn't a torpedo, wasn't a mine, probably not a drone. Those tend to hit from up top if it's one of those, you know, planes, drones they have. So this is the reality, and this is still what's happening over there as of March 4th. Feels like, again, there really ought to be some concern at this stage. Oil's been drifting down all morning, apparently.
Apparently. Well, and from what I understand, Treasury Secretary Bessent came out and said, we're going to have some announcements that are going to help the oil prices. And quite frankly, the algorithms will react to that. I mean, their computer trading programs, they're going to react to that as long as the news narrative coming out is positive. Maybe that's impacting it right now. I don't know. But look, in all of warfare, what do you want to do? You want to bring your enemy into a bottleneck to where you can drive them into a certain area. We know the drones that Iran's been using and investing into, $20,000 drones. I mean, what's going to happen to a ship, even if it's being escorted by a destroyer or one of our Navy ships? Let's say we do that, and they send 1,000 or 2,000 drones in there all at one time, plus a missile barrage. I mean, that's not going to increase confidence if one of our ships were struck, or if one of the ships that they're transporting is struck. So why would you even take that risk at this point?
You wouldn't. I think that's why the Navy kind of backed up and said, no, bad idea. They're standing really far off, as they have to, because Iran's got all kinds of missiles that can reach pretty far out. Anti-ship missiles, mm-hmm. ballistic missiles, they got the drones. They still have some subs kicking around. So very fluid situation. But the thing that I think is weird to me, Paul, is how the market, as much as we can trust, it's not just, you know, sort of that somebody doesn't have their thumb on the scale so that people don't panic, or we wouldn't want anybody to get the wrong ideas about how great we're doing and how badly they're doing, right? Or whatever the story is, that by doing that, they're really underplaying for people how serious the situation is. So from my standpoint, this is the most serious energy crisis since 1973, and that took months and years to play out over time. And I think that to the extent people are just looking at the price of oil drifting lower today, they might get the wrong impression about just how serious this is. So let's just be clear. All the oil that used to come through the Strait of Hormuz is not flowing through the Strait of Hormuz. Because we don't have empty ships coming in, say, to Iraq in particular, Iraq doesn't have a whole lot of storage capability. They got some, but the whole idea is you pump it out of a field, goes through a pipeline, goes in a big holding tank, then it goes into a ship. And so it's a constant flow. But if you don't have the ship there to receive it, this starts to fill up. And once it hits a certain height, you're like, stop. So they shut down the West Kurna 2 field yesterday, 450,000 barrels a day. And today they just announced they had to shut down the Rumaya field. That's 1.2 million barrels a day. And they'll probably have to take another 1.5 million barrels offline if this carries on for another day or two. We're about to lose millions and millions and millions of barrels of oil from the world's supply for an indefinite period of time. That ought to be causing, I would think, some concern.
It should. The only thing that seems to be reacting is gasoline prices at this point. They seem to be, at least when I looked a few minutes ago, they were at the highs for the day. But, you know, one thing I want to point out to people is that we forget is the just-in-time inventory component of that, right? So maximum profitability for a corporation is to get it here just in time and time to sell it. So what you're talking about is just-in-time inventory, right? Instead of storing it here, we're just going to pump it right in, then we're going to ship it out. Go back to COVID and remember people not being able to get toilet paper because we realized with full reality and experience of how tight that just-in-time inventory supply chain was. Oil is going to be no different. So if this is protracted, I mean, you're stopping the refining capabilities. You know, the refiners, I'm sure they have some inventory. You can correct me on this, Chris, but I'm sure they have the ability to store as they put through, but still you've got to bring that in because I'm sure because of just-in-time technology, they've not invested in massive ability to store it within these refineries. So it's going to continue to work its way through the system. And what happens? The more money we have sloshing around, and especially in something that is needed for transportation, going to work, everything that we utilize in our society, supply and demand means those prices are just going to go up. And yeah, the market doesn't seem to be taking this risk into consideration at all. And my question is the market calculating this correctly? Is the market saying, oh, the U.S. is and Israel is going to win this war? They're going to be able to control all of the circumstances. Or is it arrogance and complacency and that pride that comes before a fall? You know, maybe it doesn't go perfect, but the market seems to be pricing perfection at this point. And at least over the weekend, when information was a lot easier to gather, there was a lot of we didn't see that coming in Iran's response. And I don't hear that so much now, but initially, before information seemed to be throttled, there was a lot of surprise to Iran's response, which means we don't know everything.
And the information is super throttled. So you made a great point there, right? If I'm a refiner, I don't want to store a lot of oil, to be honest. It's capital just sitting there, right? So if I have to store a million extra barrels, well, a million times 70, I have $70 million of capital that's just parked there. So making a strategic petroleum reserve is a great idea. Maybe companies should do it, but it's not really their thing given their capital requirements. So that's what a country should do. And of course, China has done extraordinarily. They've built theirs up. They have probably last I checked, it was between 1.3 and 1.4 billion barrels in their strategic petroleum reserve. So that's a lot, right? 1.3, 1.4. Let's say it's 1.3. They got about 5 million barrels a day out of the Gulf. So if they had to replace that 100% from their SPR, 5 into 1,300, it's about 240 days they can go without any trouble. The United States, under Biden, drained its SPR. This is our ending strategic petroleum reserve. And you see it hit a high of almost 750,000 times 1,000. So 750 million barrels was our top out. here just around 2010, but coming in through COVID and all that other stuff in the elections, we bottomed that out at about, I think we bottomed out at about 320 million barrels. And we put a little back in under Trump. This is a little bit, it's going back in, but we're probably parked here at about 380, I'm going to guess, off of this. So we have 380, and China has 1.3 billion. We have 0.3 billion-ish, 0.4, somewhere in that zone. So if we really started to hit that hard, we wouldn't have that many days. We our refiners burn through about 21 million barrels of oil a day. We ship a lot out, so we don't use all of that. And we do produce about 13. So if we had to, we could pinch things and get tight and survive for a while. But the United States, we also have, you know, I guess we could commandeer Venezuela's oil and maybe make some deals with Canada, you know, because I think North America, including Venezuela, we would be pretty much okay here for a while. And things would get harder and all that, and things would get more expensive, but we would not be in the situation that Europe is in. They are in deep trouble in this. Japan, deep trouble. Japan imports 100% of its hydrocarbons. 100%. So they're very exposed. And so, Paul, all those things you and I have been talking about with Japan and the carry trade and the yen and, you know, spiking Japanese yields, this comes at a really bad moment for what you and I have been talking about is already kind of a precarious Japanese situation. They're now going to have to print yen like crazy if they have to pay double for LNG or double for oil or any of that stuff. That's going to be very hard for that model over there.
And you know, and what that reminds me of is you think about China, as you were talking about just how much they have put into their strategic reserves. Mm-hmm. You think about where China has come from, let's just say over the past 200 years, right? There's not been anybody there to bail them out. They've not, I mean, here recently they've been an economic power, but let's go back through the generations. It's not like they've just been able to do like the West has done or the U.S. has done and just print money to cover things. I know they've printed money, so y'all just bear with my thought process here. They don't have that savior, kinsman, redeemer, that uncle. So, you know, they're like the individual who saved. That's their emergency fund as a nation, right? They're in a position to be able to continue, and if they tighten their belt, they could stretch that out a little bit longer. Where the U.S. has gotten in an arrogant position to where, oh, I don't need an emergency fund. I've got an uncle that'll bail me out, or I've got a parent that'll bail me out, or I've got a trust fund that'll bail me out. And that goes through that cycle again, that weak men and women create hard times because they can't control their impulses. They don't want to make the short-term sacrifices to build that foundation because they're more interested in spending every penny that they have. Now, there are people that have to spend every penny, okay, because the economy is tight and inflation is high. But let's just talk about the person that has the capacity for something extra. Spending every penny because they're more concerned about impressing those that are around them than building a solid foundation that they're on because somebody's always been there to bail them out. My concern is that the U.S. is overly arrogant at this point. We don't feel like we need savings because we'll just print money. Well, just because we were able to print money after 2008 forward without severe inflation doesn't mean that we're in the environment where we can continue to do that going forward without that inflationary impact. Because what we're seeing is now extra fiscal stimulus, extra money, interest rates low too long does have that inflationary pressure because we've wrung out all of the deflationary pressure over the next 10 years from the 2008 crisis. Plus, you've got the dollar's not losing its global reserve status, but when you look at gold, right, gold seems to be the reserve status of choice at this point for big countries around the world, and I think it's just a lack of trust. So we're in a completely different environment right now, but our arrogance within our country seems to be operating under the belief that nothing wrong can happen to us. And that's the most dangerous situation that we can be in because that, you know, pride comes before the fall. I mean, that we all know that happens. We don't know when that pride leads to that fall, but it's the weakness of operating in that pride and that arrogance that causes us to be blind. Because instead of having your head on a swivel and taking every step with fear and trembling, not that we should be scared, but every step with diligence, you're walking through a minefield with confidence that nothing's going to happen to you. And that's where I believe that we are right now. We're, you know, as leadership in our country, walking through a minefield with the utmost arrogance that for whatever reason, nothing wrong can happen to us. And that's the biggest concern that I have right now. The markets are acting that way for whatever reason. And if this doesn't go perfect, maybe it does, but if it doesn't go perfect, there's already enough pressures building in the system to deliver a lot of pain to the average citizen that's putting their faith in the wrong place.
Can't disagree. I mean, we look at how the whole Iran war unfolded. Little disagreement, who shot first? Was it Israel or was it the U.S.? Did we know? Did they know? Whatever. We both did it together. And it immediately did not go according to plan, right? That was the next day. They're like, nobody expected that. We thought Iran would just sort of take their licks, be beheaded. They were going to take days, weeks to figure something out. Within 5 minutes of that strike, there were missiles going at every U.S. base and now embassies. So it's spiraled out of control. And that's, I think, why they have to sort of clamp the news down. But, you know, Paul, I wish I lived in a country that would be honest and say, hey, we did this thing. Maybe it wasn't the best idea. There are real consequences. We've lost people. Let's be honest about that, because these are real humans, right, who we put in harm's way. And let's talk about what's really happening. So as a nation, we can sort of plot a course through this. What do we want to do, right? No. They're not going to do any of that. I'll show you what it looks like when you have a leadership that does care about your people. So this is China's apparent inventory. So the way they sort of look at this is, well, they look at how much they're producing plus imports, and then anything they export is subtracted, and then refinery processing, they take that away. And so when we look at this, you know, they're just like piling in, you know, tens of millions of barrels, tens of millions over time. So that's, you know, just massive amounts. So that's what they're doing. They're stockpiling oil because they say, you know, probably it'd be good to have some of that on hand. They've been stockpiling copper. They've been stockpiling food. They've been stockpiling basically everything, because I think they're living in what I call the real world. The real world is you have it or you don't, right? If you have it, you have options. We're kind of counting on the idea that if we just can push the paper price down far enough, well, that's the price and we'll be able to get it for that amount, right? So it's more of a what I would call a fantasy-based approach, a market-based approach versus a mercantilist or a reality-based approach. I think that's the big collision, and we're about to find out that one of these is a dominant strategy, and one of them is actually not worth the paper it's printed on. You probably can figure out which way I lean as a hard assets guy.
Yeah. Well, and what amazes me is the dramatic rise in how much they have been saving and investing into putting those stockpiles in there. So what changed? There's several things that have changed. One, are they positioning themselves for the rollout of the unit? Are they getting rid of their dollars to reinvest quicker now because they see the end game of a competition against the U.S. dollar coming? Are they preparing for war? You know, who knows? But I mean, it's prudent on their part to build a solid foundation so that they have options, right? I mean, that's one thing. Go back to how many people back during COVID wanted to not take the shot, but they couldn't because it was either I lose my house, I lose my job, I lose everything because I don't have adequate savings for options, and I do something that I don't want to do. So they're giving themselves flexibility from a long-term standpoint by building that reserve, which is a good lesson for us as individuals in a period of time like this that's uncertain. You know, I've said this a lot, and I'm not going to regret it. Beef up your reserves. Beef up your emergency fund. If you're not, you know, a minimum of 12 months, ideally out to 24 months. And sure, you might sacrifice a little bit of that to inflation. But if things go awry, now you have options. Now you have staying power. If you don't have to use that money and things come apart and you're good, now it's opportunity money to reinvest, you know, when prices are reasonable instead of ridiculously overvalued.
And we also learned all across the UAE, Bahrain, up through Abu Dhabi, all of it, that that the electronic systems weren't working for some reason. I think a data center got hit. And so people couldn't, like, use credit cards. The ATMs ran out of cash really quick, and all of that. So the other piece of advice is have some cash on hand, right? Just in case, you know, if the systems go down.
You know what? That I was actually thinking that as you brought that up. That's one thing I would encourage people, because what it was reported last night that the Federal Reserve's ACH system went down for a period of time.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean,
and that's the settlement system. So for people who don't know what that is, Paul, that ACH is the clearinghouse. It's that settlement system. So if the ACH isn't working, like I couldn't like move money between bank accounts. I couldn't wire anything. Like it freezes the whole payment system for a while. Mm-hmm. The settlement system, at any rate. So, yes. Wow. Did they ever give us a reason why that happened?
No, I never heard a reason behind it. The only thing that I did see around the edges is, you know, hey, what if there is a cyber attack that was to hit the banking system, which can happen during war? And I encourage people, stick some cash in the glove box of your car. Okay, let's say you're traveling somewhere, you're away from the house, and you need to fill up your car, and the credit card system goes down. Have enough cash where you can go in there and pay for filling up your car, having some food that you need to purchase in the interim period. Now, I'm not a believer that you need 12 months worth of cash sitting in a safe somewhere, but I would have enough to get food, supplies, fuel. You know, if the banking system were to go down, if you've got a mortgage, there's no way to pay your mortgage, right? But if you don't have any cash, the credit card's not going to work. How are you going to buy food at the grocery store? So make sure you've got enough. That's just good to have from time to time.
Yep.
Anyway.
So speaking of ghosts in the machine and glitches in the system, you know, we talked about how the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the CME, Paul, had some glitches, right? And it turned out that, and those affected silver, you know, and people speculated was at it, but it actually hit two markets, metals and natural gas, one day. And so they looked into it, and the CME group looked into it, and there was some traders were looking to get some losses that they had experienced because the system went down, and these were natural gas traders. So these are fairly significant sized hedge funds. And so the CME rejected it. And the quote from the article, which made me put the little clown world on there, was this, is, quote, "The rejection has infuriated traders who are already smarting from the CME's lack of detailed explanations of what triggered the January outage in a subsequent disruption on February 25th, just a day after the claims were denied," end quote. Like, no. We're not going to tell you what the outage was, and we're going to deny that your claims have any merit.
Unbelievable.
How do you, our markets are being turned into clown shows. I mean, that's not, you can't do that. Paul, if I had read this headline 10 years ago, I would have said that's implausible. That's not a, it's not a reasonable script that you can operate.
Right. Well, but if there's no government regulatory institution to enforce the truth, And it all becomes narrative, then their monopolistic position, at least within the United States, pretty much allows them to do whatever they want to do at this point, which is completely opposite of what's happening in Shanghai on their exchange. What, there was another two to five? Can you remember? I guess did you see the headline? They removed another two traders off of their platform because they felt like they were trying to manipulate the price. So they seem to truly be wanting honest markets. But
yeah, so in their futures markets, for people listening, they felt that there were participants who were misusing their accounts, right? Making too many trades or doing them suspiciously, or, you know, potentially doing wash trading where one account's buying and the other selling, but they do it just below market to drive the price down if that's what their strategy is, et cetera. So they detected that, just suspended the accounts instantly, and are going to investigate those individuals. And if they find out there's wrongdoing, there's going to be serious consequences. China doesn't mess around with that stuff because they understand that the perception, if not the reality, of your market being open and fair is actually a cornerstone of it being a good place to be. You know, be kind of like, well, we have all these laws against murder and robbery in our city. We don't enforce any of them, you know?
Right.
That wouldn't be such a good place to live, right?
No. Hey, and that's one of the reasons you take Dubai. I mean, you know, you were sharing about how you can leave your laptop on a car. I think I told this a couple of years ago, a friend of a girl that I graduated high school with, her husband was working in Dubai in the banking industry. And she had been working in Australia at the U.S. consulate. So she came over to visit him and was doing some interviews because she was going to move over there. So she gets out of the taxi, leaves her purse sitting in the taxi. She gets up on the 100th floor of whatever building she was in, walks up to the receptionist and realizes that she left her purse. In a panic, the receptionist says, "Don't worry about it. He'll find you. And just sit over there. He'll be up here in a few minutes." And sure enough, about 15 minutes later, he went in, found out where she went, delivered her purse to her, and wouldn't even take an extra tip, goes out the car and does his job. Because the consequences for theft in Dubai, the rule of law matters, right? Mm-hmm. And that's something that has made them become this hub in that area, which is the rule of law actually matters. They have an honest law.
The CME... not so much.
No, not so much. Well, no. Circuit breakers don't work. But what did that do? That helped bail out somebody that was short on the wrong side. And, you know, I didn't go verify, but the rumor was that JP Morgan closed out their shorts at the exact bottom of the day. If those circuit breakers had have actually operated the way they wanted to, maybe you wouldn't have had that cascade sell-off. And they're there for a reason. They're supposed to be triggered. Mm-hmm. So I would expect the regulators to come in and say, "Hey, this is a massive fine. You've not done what you said you were going to do." But no, there doesn't seem to be any consequences to them.
No. So when silver was going through its two major waterfall moments, no circuit breakers got triggered at all. They didn't work. It's a weird thing. And then, but when silver was close to a breakout twice, one at 94 and the other at like about 90 the other day, there were technical issues that closed the market for whole chunks of time, right?
Yeah.
And then they're like, "We're not going to tell you what those technical issues are." But when you squint at the data, in one of those, apparently 31,000 silver contracts got traded during that close when it was technically closed. So how does that happen? Well, that's because a big player calls them up, says, "We're in deep trouble here. Just close the market for a minute." And then they go do some backroom deal. "Hey, Paul, you're China, say, or, you know, Switzerland or some other country, and you're like, listen, I know you hold these 31,000 contracts and you're expecting delivery. It's not going to happen. You're not getting it. But we'll give you a little vig on top of, like, this is the current price right now. We'll, you know, it's 94. We'll give you 104. Best offer, take it or leave it," right? And I think that's what happened in those moments. Best guess.
Yeah, that seems to be the most probable outcome, or it does. And so...
But they don't even feel like, Paul, they don't feel like they owe us any explanation. Like, even the people who are suing, who are their big traders, their clients, their customers are saying, "Hey, you caused losses. What happened?" And they're like, "We're not going to tell you. And, you know, you have no claim to be made here."
Bizarre. Well, and the worst part about this is it makes for a fragile system. The truth is always going to come out in the end. The truth, well, I say that. You take a lot of things that the government's been able to hide for quite some time, but the truth will come out in the end. And that sets for the risk of a violent repricing. And the narrative will fade as the truth comes out. And that's my concern about the U.S. markets right now, is just the excess complacency that is there. We seem to be priced for a perfect outcome. And, you know, the future's hard to predict. It's a complex system. And especially with what Iran seems to be doing, if their capabilities to keep the Straits of Hormuz shut down, if they actually can or deliver some major strikes in that area, I mean, you know, we can insure all the boats in the world, but those boats aren't easy to build, right? So if you lose too many of them, then you lose that just-in-time inventory capacity from a longer-term standpoint. Now, from what I understand, China can produce boats in a massive and quickly. So, you know, but that's just going to further line the pockets of Chinese citizens at our expense.
Well, and China can also make missiles really quickly.
Yes.
Like, really quickly. So, and by the way, I mean, just look again, even if it's rainbows and unicorns right now, there are going to be impacts that are going to take months to sort of resolve to get back up to full production. And so maybe that just makes things tight for a while. But there's another feature here, Paul, that happens, which is that when you shut an oil field down, it's not as simple as like a hose. I have a hose running and I just turn the stopcock off and then later I open it back up again. There's some oil fields that are like that. They're pretty generous, right? But for most of them, there's this super complicated petroleum engineering reservoir management process ongoing, where you're trying to squeeze the most out of this thing you can. So it's a very careful balance of pressures and infill drilling and water squeeze. It's like very, very complicated. I won't even begin to pretend to know how these fields are configured. I just know that for any given field, if you emergency shut it off and then turn it back on again, for most of them, rule of thumb, you've harmed it a little bit. Right? It's not going to quite come back to where it was. And again, they can all behave a little bit differently, but it's being reported now by Walter Bloomberg here, and this is from a Bloomberg article saying that oil storage is nearing capacity as Hormuz remains closed. And so all the Middle Eastern producers are running out of storage, like we mentioned with Iraq. And so Iraq has already cut production. Saudi Arabia, UAE may follow within weeks. So we'll see. Saudi Arabia has a pipeline that runs over to the Red Sea that maybe they can start using, but it can't make up for all of the all of it. So at any rate, this I think this needs to be taken more seriously than it is right now. And we're not having a serious conversation about this in Western media. I watch what CNN and MSNBC are not saying about any of this, or when they get close to saying something about it, they don't have any of the detail. There's no nuance. They don't bring on real experts. They bring on people who basically say, oh, I think the United States is going to prevail quickly, and markets are discounting that, you know, and expecting that.
Yeah.
You know?
So they bring the marketing firms on.
Yeah, speculation.
So, I mean, this is the time. The only thing that I can encourage people to do is, look, you have to, at this point, take it as an opportunity to develop a plan if you don't have one. You know, the question is, at what point does the information lead you to lower the risk in your portfolio? I know exactly what that is for the assets that we're managing for clients. Now, if we cross that threshold, that's what I call a decision point. I have to go back to Carl Swindlen. He's since retired, but his company was called Decision Point. And that's right. You reach a point where you have to make a decision. You've got to keep your emotions in check, because if this narrative and the truth and reality works its way out and the markets start reacting violently, you need to have a plan in place so that you're not making emotional decisions, because emotional decisions can get you in trouble from a long-term standpoint. Emotional decisions may look good if you make the right emotional decision in the short run, but the one thing that makes the market so hard is emotional decisions will not consistently produce positive outcomes. So you have to feel the fear and do it anyway sometimes. And that's the one thing that I can encourage people is just make the decision ahead of time. At what point is there a line crossed that I have to take some action in my portfolio? You know, the one thing that I would say right now is we have enough information that if you do not have an emergency fund built up, you need that resiliency. Okay, so what if you miss a little bit of opportunity? Make sure you've got 12 months to 24 months worth of emergency funds set aside, and there's ways you can help protect that against inflation. But make sure you've got some of that insurance and resiliency built in, because it's going to give you options. And more than anything, if this does spiral out into a major economic calamity, inflation spikes up again and we have a reaction in the markets like we did in 1973, where the market goes down, or 74, when the market goes down 50%+, when inflation's going up and unemployment goes up, at a minimum, you might use those reserves down, but there's a difference between using those reserves down and then being able to build them back up again once things settle down, versus you're gone on your reserves and now you're having to borrow money, you're having to build up on your credit cards, and you're paying 20-25% interest, and that sets you back, instead of a speed bump, that sets you back decades potentially. And what's even worse is if you determine yourself to be a buy and hold investor, you're going to be passive, then what happens if you're forced to liquidate those investments at the worst time because you don't have the wherewithal to ride through that downturn? So Wall Street's not going to teach you that, because they get paid on assets under management. So they're going to be like, hey, you don't need an emergency fund. I mean, I've heard it coming out now that you only need, you know, 60 days, because that's more than enough. Well, history teaches us that you need a whole lot more than 60 days, especially when the cost of things are going up. So I just encourage people to really look at their situation, you know, and go through not only on your emergency fund and build that up, go through your portfolios. If you're, you know, do you want to ride passive through this? If not, what's your strategy going to be? And then I would also go in here and look at making sure my food stores were built up a little bit. Because what if this spirals into another, you know, major global war? We're just in time inventory at our grocery stores. We're just in time inventory and everything. Take the opportunity while times are good right now and your assets are built up to build some resiliency in there. I mean, I'm a big believer you should have at least 3 months worth of food on hand. Build it into your pantry and rotate your stock, right? I mean, if you've got the space for it, when you go buy something new at the grocery store, pull it off the front shelf and put it back there. And that's just a level of diligence that you hope you never have to have that 3 months worth of food. But God forbid something happens, it'll be the most valuable asset that you have if you have taken the time to do that. So I know you encourage people this through Crash Course, everything that you do, Chris. I just want to state it here. You know, there's nothing wrong with being cautious and prudent. Prudence, you know, and again, we've talked about this before. Proverbs, which is my favorite book of the Bible. I have others that are right there along with it, but it's application. So it's warning, it's wisdom. The prudent foresee danger and hide themselves while the simple go on and are judged for it. Simple pass on and are judged for it. It tells us twice, okay? And to me, that says that hey, pay attention, right? Anytime I have to tell my kids something, I tell them twice. Or if I have to tell somebody something that's really important, I make sure I tell them two or three times. So be prudent right now. Just take inventory of your circumstances. You don't have to do it out of fear and panic, but go build these up and make sure you're resilient, because you'll have options now if things go wrong. And things can go wrong. And if we don't assume that they can go wrong, then we're living with a level of pride and arrogance that makes us believe that we're untouchable. And one thing Jordan Peterson stated years ago that I thought was pretty phenomenal in his statement, he says, you know, if life is full of tragedy, so if things have been going really good for you, it's just a matter of time before tragedy impacts you. There are people who get through this life without experiencing any tragedy, but that is a rarity. So that's the thing about life. Unfortunately, bad things happen. Do what you can do to make sure that you're resilient, because is it possible that this could spin out of control? Absolutely. I think it's greater now than what it has been at any time in the past. Is it possible that we could pull this off to perfection and there's no ripple effect? Yeah, that's possible too. But the consequences of this spinning out of control and hitting the markets and the economy and supply chains and inflation coming back are much more severe to each of us individually than what it is if we get the perfect outcome. So take the opportunity while you have it to build some resiliency and make some decisions on how you're going to behave in your portfolio so that you're not making panic decisions, because those don't lead out to good outcomes.
Well, it is time, absolutely, for people to begin, I think, to take risk management a lot more seriously. And I would invite everybody, believe your lying eyes, you know. You decide what you think. Paul, I've started to disconnect from the signals the market's trying to tell me, like, this is what silver is worth, this is what gold is worth, this is what oil's worth. I've decided there's a lot of noise in those signals, and so I just decide for myself, right? And I can decide for myself right now. I can see this global energy shock is beginning to unfold. I don't have to wait for it to all the way unfold for me to begin to take actions around that. So I think everybody should do that in their portfolios. And if you want to talk with Paul and his amazing team, please go to peakfinancialinvesting.com and fill out a simple form, and somebody from Paul's team will be in touch with you within 48 business hours to set up a meeting, hopefully the first of three. Get an introductory phone call, a planning call session, and then a strategy or recommendation call if you go that far. And then if it all seems to work out, well, maybe you work together.
And if we're working together and things come apart, I have decision points on every particular, every position that's in the portfolio, right? Well, I can always show exactly why we purchased what we purchased. I can always show exactly why we sold what we sold, because we have strategies in place that, look, you can't time the market. You never know when the top is. You never know when the bottom is. But you can gauge risk reward and have your decision points where, hey, I have enough information right now that the downside risk is so much greater than the upside potential that it's not a good allocation of our funds, and then we deploy that in other ways. So it helps keep those emotions in check. It helps keep people to stay calm, knowing that there's somebody that will do their best to make decisions to protect their capital if things come apart. I see a lot of fear and worry with individuals that have been passive, but they finally understand the risks of that from a long-term standpoint. And I hear time and time again say, look, we know you're not going to be perfect over the long term, but we just have peace of mind knowing that somebody's going to attempt to manage that downside risk and has a strategy that's designed to protect if things come apart and make adaptations if we get an inflationary holocaust, because you've got to be able to adapt both ways. That's what we do for people.
Well, thanks for that. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And again, go to peakfinancialinvesting.com if you have any more questions. Paul, trade safe. Have a great rest of your week and weekend, and we'll see you next week.
You as well, Chris. Look forward to seeing you next week.